Okay, welcome everybody to episode 40 of the Academy of Management Review Origin Series. Once again, this is the series that takes us behind the scenes of an AMR paper. When we first stepped into our role as AMR and AMR editorial team, we realized that a lot of more junior scholars don't have the perspective of what it takes to write an AMR paper and what goes into the development and the revision of that paper over time. And hence, we launched this series to tell some of the stories behind those journeys. And we're now at episode 40. We've got a lot of stories behind us, but we've got a fantastic paper to discuss today. So we're going to be discussing a paper with a very simple title, but an impactful title: Where Do Stakeholders Come From? And this is a paper by Sharon Alvarez and Sybil Sachs. So Sharon, you want to just start off by telling us a little bit about who you are, where you come from, for those who've been under a rock for the last few years and don't know those details.
Yeah, thank you. So, thank you very much. Thank you for doing this. And thank you to AMR for doing this. I think this is a very, very important initiative that this particular AMR team has taken on. And kudos to you and thank you for your service. My name is Sharon Alvarez. I'm currently the Tom Olofsson Chair of Entrepreneurial Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. My identity right now, though, is wrapped up in being I'm the incoming AMR AOM president. So that is taking quite a bit of my time right now. I'm an old entrepreneurship scholar, and I think that's the only way I can say this. I was in the field. In fact, Greg, I think I tried to hire you when you were a junior scholar and I was already senior. So this scares me a lot, right? But I was in the field, and I remember I started off in the field of entrepreneurship. I remember people telling me entrepreneurship is where good academics go to die. And I'm glad I ignored that. I'm glad I ignored what people said. And I'm happy to be here with you today.
Yeah. Sharon was the lead faculty when I was in the doctoral consortium in the second year of my PhD program. So that was where we first met, in Chicago. Sybil, what about you? Give us a little bit of your background.
Okay, thank you so much for the invitation, for the possibility also to introduce myself. My story is absolutely different. I'm coming from Switzerland. I'm affiliated with the University of Applied Sciences for Business Administration in Zurich. And I had the opportunity very early in my days to meet people from the business and society community. And that's how my career started, to be engaged in this community and also to be affiliated to stakeholder theory. Stakeholder theory is my main topic. And from the very beginning in my career, I was interested, how can we bring stakeholder theory to the management studies as a topic that is really integrated? So I was invited to a conference, and there I had the opportunity to meet Sharon. And it was a wonderful coincidence that we had this possibility. And it was also my first coincidence to learn more about entrepreneurial theory. And I think, here we are after many years of work, right, Sharon?
Yeah, we met in 2015 and started working on the paper pretty much in 2015.
Well, that has been one of the themes that's come out of the Origin series, is that although AMR papers don't have data, and hence you don't need to go through that whole process, they still take a lot of time to write, a lot of time to develop and mature into something that's ultimately publishable. So it doesn't surprise me. But it's also interesting to hear that we've got two people coming from slightly different sort of intellectual groundings or histories. Sharon much more from the entrepreneurship space and Sybil much more from the stakeholder space. And hence we get this paper, which really looks at what happens when we bring the two together and how do we think about where stakeholders come from. But Sharon, can you just give us a sort of high-level view or an elevator pitch of what is this paper essentially about beyond the simple answering of the question that you've got as the title?
You know, so it's interesting, and we'll go back to, but, you know, basically our argument is that new to the world ideas are introduced by human beings, right? And entrepreneurship is about humans creating a new future. It's all about the human condition. And I've got a little blurb and I'm going to look at it because I wanted to have some structure to this. But, you know, the paper puts humans and then stakeholders ultimately at the forefront of entrepreneurship in firms, right? It suggests that the emergence of stakeholders comes prior to the formation of an entrepreneurial opportunity and the emergence of the firm. So it really does take the entrepreneurship process, but it brings those stakeholders really quickly and it explains how they drive the process. And, you know, we use the theory of common ground, and I see you kind of furrowing your eyebrows. So I'm going to let you ask questions here in a little bit. But, you know, one of the reasons that common ground became so important for us comes out of linguistics, and it talks about how things form, if you will. And in linguistics, they call them conversational experiments, and we call them conversational experiments in the paper. But basically, you know, I'm wandering around someday doing whatever it is I'm doing, probably walking my dog. And, you know, I see something that I think is kind of interesting or different or, you know, not consistent with all of my experiences. And I happen to mention it to Sybil. And Sybil's like, you know, that is kind of interesting. And now we're having a conversation with you, Greg, and we mention it to you and you're like, you know, that is kind of interesting, right? So we start talking about this different thing, if you will. And it's not really a concrete idea yet. It's not really, you know, it's just we're having these experiments and we're building. We each are building on each other's conversation. And eventually we're like, wow, maybe this is an interesting idea and maybe there's something there. So then we, you know, and we may be bringing other people and we may say, you know, I don't know enough about this. Let's find someone who does know something. And then, you know, pretty soon we start to really coalesce into something that we think is of interest and becomes a common ground. Now we hear common ground tossed around a lot today, and I'm going on more and more, but I'll finish with this. We hear the term common ground tossed around. We hear politics. They're always talking about, oh, we have to find a common ground. But it really is a theory, and it has some pretty concrete assumptions, right? About you have to have, in order to have common ground, your beliefs, your values, your knowledge, and language. You will have a language that reflects this common ground, that is unique to the common ground and may be exported later on, but for the time being, we're using it to help us make meaning of this thing that we're trying to understand. And all of that comes before we even think about entrepreneurial opportunities, before we even think about firms, right? And what we argue in the paper is that as soon as we have invested in each other and the common ground, we have something at stake at this point. And that stake makes us stakeholders. And so these human beings that are stakeholders come prior to everything else that goes on.
So it's the concrete or explicit recognition that the earliest phases of entrepreneurship, even before we might think of it as such, do not happen in a vacuum. They happen through conversation, through interaction with others, and those others get or form some kind of stake in what's emerging through this conversational process. And it's what you've done, and what I want to point out is you've taken a theory that exists in another domain or in another literature, and utilized it to explain this thing that entrepreneurial practitioners and others who think more critically about entrepreneurship probably recognize, but don't have the theoretical apparatus or the tools to account for it. And being able to account for it by looking broader than just the entrepreneurship literature and saying, what could we bring from elsewhere that's going to help us unpack and explain this notion of stakeholder formation, stakeholder creation around something that's initially just very ethereal and very, very unclear. And it becomes clearer and clearer and clearer as these stakeholders come on board.
Right. And as they talk to each other, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how many times have you had a paper and you're kind of thinking about this and you're thinking about that, but it's when you have a conversation with your colleagues that you start to clarify it, right? You clarify it for yourself, you clarify it for your colleagues help you, you know, help you by saying something and you're like, oh, okay, I hadn't thought about it that way, right? And so it is, you know, the thing that for me, and I will let Sybil jump in here in a second, but the thing for me that has kind of bothered me a little bit about some of the work that's going on in entrepreneurship is it forgets that it's human beings. Entrepreneurs aren't ants. They aren't machines, although it may be artificial intelligence soon, but right. But up until now, right, it isn't trees. It is human beings who are entrepreneurs. And we want to take away how human beings act and say, oh, this is what entrepreneurship is all about, right?
Yeah.
And it's not. It's about human beings being human beings.
So, Sybil, when and where and how did the recognition that this common ground theory, which comes from linguistics, if I'm not mistaken, what was the process behind recognizing, oh, this could really help us explain what's going on here? Did it come in really early and you started from that point, or were you exploring and then discovered? Can you give us a little bit of the back story to bringing in common ground theory?
We had this notion of common ground already in the multi-stakeholder setting when you have to find common ground. So this notion was around, but it was not really grounded in the theory itself. So when Sharon and I really tried to find out what is happening here, as I said, well, we should have a look at common ground theory. So we started to read this book, and this took us several days, right, Sharon, to understand this book, because even though it was written from a linguistic person, it was impossible written. It was nearly not understandable. However, at the end of the day, we really found out that this experimenting through this conversation, this iterating of the idea is so important, and also explains how the people are getting emotional attracted even to ideas may have no clue what the outcome will be. And this gives us explanation to things that are already stated in entrepreneurship theory and also in stakeholder theory, but we didn't have so far a really sound theoretical explanation. So we really have been excited when we found out that the common ground theory could be of great help here to develop this process and to understand how the stakeholders are emerging and later on also the entrepreneurial endeavor.
Now, Sharon, one of the things you're really good at is taking complex ideas and using metaphors or simple language and explanations to explain them. You did it with Jay in your creation versus discovery paper, and you spoke about climbing Everest. And here you've used a metaphor again to explain the common ground theory. And it's interesting for me to hear from Sybil that it was so complex when you first read about it, because you use a fairly simple metaphor just to set it up, explain it, and make it accessible to all AMR readers. Can you tell us a little bit about that metaphor and the choice to use it and sort of how you developed the understanding of this common ground theory through this metaphor?
So it's interesting because we were the right. So the reviewers, they were just like perplexed by this whole common ground thing, right? And you know, Sybil and I were, and as Sybil states, the original work is really very complex. I'm like, for people in linguistics, this is very complex to read, right? And it was the editors actually, because we had written something that was theoretically almost straight out, and the editors said, well, you know, when I go hiking with my friends, you know, all we do is argue. You should. And Sybil and I were like, that's precisely the point. The point that you can argue and come to some kind of an agreement means you have to have common ground. And so we just said, we're taking that and we're running with it, right? And because you can't even argue with somebody. Right. So if we had a Martian that came down to Earth, we have so little common ground with that Martian, we couldn't communicate with that Martian. Right. You have to have common ground to even be able to talk to somebody. And then what we love about the conversational experimentation that goes on, right, that's where you're negotiating. That's where the negotiations are going on, and you're negotiating values, you're negotiating knowledge, you're negotiating beliefs, and you may come up with a totally, you know, chat GPT or Facebook or Bitcoin, right? You may come up with totally new words, but they're a result of that negotiation.
So talk to me a little bit about the target audience for this paper, because clearly you're coming from slightly different or adjacent disciplinary and intellectual spaces. And it's clearly incorporating both the stakeholder perspective, but also an entrepreneurial perspective, but then also this linguistic perspective. So who do you each see as the primary set of readers, and then who sort of waterfalls down from that as you think about other people who might benefit from reading the paper? Sybil, shall we start with you? Just get your take. And often authors have a slightly different take on who's going to appreciate this paper the most.
Yes. I think the interesting thing is that for me, of course, the stakeholder community is forefront. And, you know, we have two assumptions in forefront, which is not so common. The first one is about, how do stakeholders emerge? Where are they coming from? Normally, we are talking about stakeholder already established. So have this possibility and this explanation that stakeholders also emerge by this conversational experiment, and that due to this conversation, they invest and have something at stake. I think this is very important to the stakeholder community. And the second thing is about uncertainty, because normally we don't talk about uncertainty in stakeholder theory. In the meantime, we have some papers. However, to take this into account and to see how stakeholders are dealing with this uncertainty of the product and service ideas, this is also very important. And I think that's how I would see that the perspective of stakeholder community is very important.
So, and what about for you, Sharon?
Yeah, I think, again, it's this notion in entrepreneurship. And I don't know if you're aware, we had a dialogue exchange with some economists on this paper. And they were like, oh, you missed the point. It's the entrepreneur, you know, that organizes the firm and leads the firm. And we're like, no, we think you missed the point. It's human beings that have to have some kind of buy-in before you even begin to talk about a firm. And you can't write contracts if you don't have language. How can you write contracts, even incomplete contracts, right? Mm-hmm. And how do you do that if you haven't done all of this pre-negotiation? And even in the entrepreneurship literature, I mean, we talk about, you know, the entrepreneur goes out and they get stakeholders to pre-commit. No, tell the stakeholders? I mean, you can maybe get them to pre-commit about things that aren't important, but about your core ideas, your core philosophies, you know, who you are as a firm. No, the stakeholders are part of it from the beginning. They're the ones who help you negotiate all this stuff. But I think, you know, again, you know, it's the stakeholder piece, it's the entrepreneurship piece. And, you know, and Sybil and I were talking about this a little bit, you know, we have implications for theory of the firm and how a firm gets organized in this. Now, most of those people are economists, so I doubt that they'll agree with us on any of this. But, you know, this has huge implications for all of the pre-negotiation, for how these firms emerge. And firms do emerge. It isn't, you know, it isn't. That's what bothers me so much about sort of this, oh, you know, we're going to put a firm together. By the time you get to that point, a lot of things have been worked out, right? And then you have to exploit. And the firm help is one way that helps you exploit entrepreneurial opportunities, ideas, whatever you want to call them. But a lot of work, that's not the genesis of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship happens way before you get to that point.
So the thing that struck me in reading the paper is really you can apply the thinking and the logic and the sort of the mechanisms at play in this sort of conversational experimentation to it's certainly salient or relevant for firms, but you could apply it to almost anything where individuals need to coalesce under conditions of some level of uncertainty, whether it's writing a research paper or engaging in a research project, as we've alluded to, starting an NGO, launching a new program at your university. All of these kinds of things necessitates stakeholders and stakeholders to ultimately buy in. But before they've bought in, you need this sort of emergence of who those potential stakeholders are. So I could see it, you know, stretching into all sorts of different areas where people come to this recognition that people are at the forefront of all these new things that happen. They happen under conditions of uncertainty. And under those conditions, this idea of conversational experimentation has major implications. So you've alluded to the fact that this started at a conference. Can you tell us just a little bit about what that conference was about and how the two of you in particular connected? And the reason this is important is because a lot of junior scholars are going to conferences all the time, and I sense that there is a little bit of uncertainty or lack of sort of understanding about how to forge relationships that might ultimately lead to impactful papers like this one. So I'd love to know the story behind this paper.
The conference was a really small conference, and it was people coming from stakeholder theory and strategy theory. And the question was about is stakeholders here at crossroad, and how is it at crossroad? So for me, it was a very important conference, and I was very glad that I could take part of it. And we had this discussion over there. And, you know, all of a sudden, you realize somebody from a very new perspective. And that happened to me with Sharon. I met her earlier on other conference, but never had a close conversation. But she seems to have similar questions than I do, even though she was coming from a completely different field, because she was really at this time inclined to ask about stakeholder enrollment. And so the question was, are these stakeholders really already around, right, if they are enrolled? And this start of conversation brought us to the questions, yeah, where do the stakeholders are coming from at the very early stage of an entrepreneurial endeavor? And with that, starting this conversation, we couldn't stop, even not after Science Park. And, well, I think that was the story. being curious, being engaged.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so sure, traditional experiments.
But you likely have, you know, you're well known in the field. You've got some seminal papers in the entrepreneurship field. So you go to conferences regularly. You likely have people all the time sort of trying to forge relationships to potentially write with you. How do you distinguish between conversational experiments with others at conferences that are actually going to be valuable versus those that you need to sidestep or you just feel are going nowhere? Is there any kind of sense you could give us of what makes something sort of productive in those initial meeting stages?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So the conversational experiment has to be interesting to me, right? And I have to get buy-in. I have to become emotionally attached to the experiment. Like, there's lots of interesting things, but you know, when I told Sybil, I said, there's no explanation in the stakeholder literature on how, right, stakeholders are given. In the stakeholder literature, stakeholders are given. And then once they're given, you go off and do whatever. Yet stakeholders are extremely important to the entrepreneurial process. And there just weren't any conversations going on necessarily about that. And, you know, and Sybil agreed, and she was intellectually, there's nothing like intellectual curiosity, right? So that's the other thing that really is so very attractive is when you meet someone who's intellectually curious. So there's a lot of people out there who come to me and they're like, oh, I have a paper. And, you know, would you give us comments? Well, yeah, no, not really. Because, you know, I have 1,000 people who are asking me that. I can't do that. Or I'd have no life. Forget a career. I wouldn't have a life. But it's different when it's a question and you're formulating a question and it's an interesting question. And I don't want to know how to test it. And I don't want to know if we can gather data on it, because that comes way down the line. For me, it's like, is this interesting? Is this something that intellectually challenges me? Is this an intellectual curiosity that we don't have an answer for? And that was how Sybil and I both started. It was intellectually curious.
And Sybil and I were saying before you joined us is that that's what's needed in these projects, because there's so much uncertainty. You don't know whether you're going to be able to get it published or not. And so if you're attaching all the enjoyment and value of the project to the outcome, you're only going to enjoy it when you see it in press. You're going to be sorely disappointed by this as a career. You've got to get enjoyment from the process, the curiosity, the exploration, the intrinsic intrigue that you've got with trying to answer a question that hasn't been answered before. And so it starts with who do you forge connections with? And then you continue down that line of just explore, keep the curiosity going, because that's the only thing we really get from these. And sometimes it will lead to a publication and sometimes it won't. So it's very relevant that you start with that as the starting point, because it's not going to just suddenly come down the line.
No. And, you know, I think that's the sadness as I think about so many junior scholars today. You know, there really is so much pressure on. You have to have those 5A hits or 4A hits or 6 or however your particular school is defining it. And, you know, I just feel like certainly when I got into this business, it was more about what's interesting? What is it that's driving me? What is it that makes me passionate? And the reason I didn't give up entrepreneurship, and I could have so very easily, you know, in the early days, is because I kept asking the question, why, like, where do these things come from, right? So that's what I didn't like about strategy. Strategy always said, this is given, and given all these things, where do you go from here? And I was like, well, where did these things come from, right? You know, where do resources come from? Which, by the way, this begins to answer that question as well, right? So both the 2007 paper and this paper, really begin to talk about where do resources get generated? How do you generate resources? Especially, we say the most important resources are socially complex resources. Well, you know, right? This is what this is all about. It's all about socially complex resources. But if you don't ask the where does it come from, if you don't push back, if you don't ask the why, you never get any place interesting.
So at the core of this paper is it's explaining a process, and there is both a visual depiction of that process with multiple things going on, but then it also unpacks that process very explicitly in terms of describing what's going on and what's interacting with what. And so I labeled this, maybe rightly or wrongly, as a form of narrative theorizing, which we see relatively less narrative theorizing compared to propositional and maybe even compared to typology-based theorizing in AMR. Can you give us a little bit of an explanation or unpack why you chose this sort of form of theorizing where you don't have propositions or you haven't broken things down into a typology, but instead it's focused on this process that unfolds over time? Number one, why you did that? And then number two, what were some of the challenges that came from trying to broach this in that way? And ultimately then, how did you overcome those challenges? And I'd love to get both your take on this. Just as a little bit of background, we've just run an idea development workshop, and this was one of the big questions. How do you do this? What are exemplar papers we can find for doing more narrative theorizing? And we didn't have as stronger or as solid answers as we would have wanted. So seeing this paper in press doing this narrative form of theorizing was really very, very relevant to the conversations we've just had. So I'd love to know, you know, why choose it? What were some of the challenges and how did you overcome some of those challenges?
I'm going to turn this over to Sybil first.
Yes, I think we never started this paper with the idea this is a narrative-based paper or we will develop a process model. But since we had this conversation, we realized that it's really phase after phase developing, and there are some points which it can fall back because the idea is not strong enough, the stakeholders are not engaged enough. Same happens to authors in a paper, right? And by the way, and after time when we really introduce this thinking of the linguistic theory, we realize it's so important to understand the process. And with understanding the process, it was quite clear that we have to rely on narrative-based theorizing, because proposition not really helps you in this way. And the typology actually would be too early. I mean, we have a distinction at the end of different kind of entrepreneurial endeavors, but it's not already in a state that we really can build a typology on that. That would be future research, actually. But with this very original idea, where do the stakeholders and entrepreneurial endeavor emerges? At the end, it's quite obvious it has to be a process, but we had to find it out, and it was quite a fight to find it out. Right, Sharon?
Well, so I'm horrible at models, right? It's just like, oh my God, you know, I agreed. I was like, okay, I know we need a model, but this is like, I'm so bad at this. And Sybil is so great. And I actually think that's just sort of your background. Sybil was able to take these complex things and then we iterated backwards and forwards, and it clarified it for our reviewers as well, right? I think one of the reviewers suggested it. I don't think, did we have a process model? I'm not sure we had the model in the early stages.
In the early stages, we didn't have it, but it was suggested by one of the reviewers.
Yeah.
And I will say it will mean your paper gets more cited because it's it's easier to cognitively process. And so you can see the big picture and you don't need to read 12 pages of text to understand what's going on. So I think it's incredibly valuable, although you would want everyone to read everything. They might not do it. But
oh, well, yes, of course, you know, that possibility. But I tell you, Sybil was a champion because, you know, she would put the models together and I'd look at them and I'd be like, and she'd be like, okay, what are you thinking, Sharon? And I'm like, I'm not sure I can even read this, right? And so we would go through it. And maybe that's the strength of the model, right? So Sybil would propose and, you know, me, who's like slow at this, a slow learner at this, would be like, okay, does this make sense to me? And then if I got to yes, we knew it would make sense to the dog, right? Because if it made sense to the dogs, right? So but we knew, right? Again, and it was a great recommendation, and we're really grateful to the reviewer that recommended that to us because it really was what the paper needed.
And I will, there's another subtle point to underline or unpack there, which is in writing, in particular, I think theory papers, it can be useful for different people in an author team to take on different roles and almost develop some aspect of the paper almost independently to start off with, like a model or a unpacking a mechanism or writing the introduction or, you know, creating a table, and then give it to the other author or other authors on the team and ask them to look at it with fresh eyes, with sort of the eyes of new readers, because that's how your reviewers are going to be looking at it and that's how your end readers are going to be looking at it. And if they can't grasp it, understand it, appreciate what's being conveyed, then it's probably not doing its job. And so that sort of tension, or not tension, but just distance between someone developing the model and someone else looking at it with fresh eyes, I think can be really, really valuable. So it's intriguing to, I've tried to institute a little bit more of that in the teams that I've worked with of late. Because if you both sit there and develop the whole thing together, then you both invested in what's been developed and you understand what you've done, but others might not as easily.
Because you're both invested in the common ground, right? Beliefs, values, language, right? Knowledge.
Other interesting thing that you do really well in this paper is you bring out some, you use salient examples, and whether it's about new things, new words being formed, or whether it's about things evolving over time and different stakeholders coming on at different points, and how, where did those, how did you manage to find examples that work so well and yet are also so common that you don't need to explain what Airbnb is or what Apple is or what Facebook is? Can you just talk to us a little bit about the process of using examples, where you found them, and how that sort of allowed you to further develop the paper over time?
So it's interesting because the reviewers kept pushing us for examples, but I grew up in a world where real theorizing didn't use examples, right? And so I was like, no, you know, this is a real theory paper. And they kept pushing us. And it wasn't until the editors said to us, we want examples, right? And once the editors said that, you know, I certainly was okay. You know, I know what it's like to be an editor. And once the editor speaks, you do what that editor asks you to do, right? So I'm like, okay, this is good. And then, but then, you know, that was the thing, all these examples, and I'll be curious, you know, to hear Sybil's take. We've never really kind of talked about how we came up with them, but all of these things, like you said, are so commonplace. Mm-hmm. And I guess the thing that's good about a good theory is it helps explain the phenomena. And so I think we really felt like we could take anything that was out there that was commonplace and that our theory would be strong enough to explain it. And even though we were doing this ex post as opposed to ex ante, you know, you know, we did put some thought into the examples, but we wanted examples of big things that were out there that had been entrepreneurial within our lifetimes. And then we went back and we really dug into the genesis of these things. And sure enough, our theory of common ground could explain it. And so, you know, I'll turn it over to you, Sybil, but that's kind of how I remember it. That I once again fought hard.
No, I think it's as you said, when we had this release by the editor, it was quite clear. And it was from the very beginning, it was obvious to us we have to find example. We don't have to explain the examples because the example are there for illustration and nothing else. So we really started to play around with this very famous example. Everybody is knowing and looked how we could introduce the theory to make the narrative out of these examples. And it was easy, as Sharon said, because each example we took was easy to adapt, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, once we went back and really looked at the origins, we're like, yeah. And so that actually empirically in some ways really made us feel good because our theory helped us explain the origins of these things. Mm. And of course, you know, who doesn't love Steve Jobs in entrepreneurship, right? I mean, he's still to this day is, you know, one of my heroes. So, you know, we talked about Steve Jobs and some of the language and how he and Wozniak came together and, you know, again, talk about common ground, right?
What's interesting in what you've said, and I think is relevant for people writing theory papers, is you actually had the theory developed first, and then you inserted the examples to make the paper a little bit more interesting, a little bit more readable, to offer some concrete perspective on what are you saying in this theory. I think the mistake that some writers of conceptual papers can sometimes make is they've got a vague idea of what their theory is about. They find the example and want to lean into the example as evidence or as the argument that the theory exists. And that falls down in an AMR paper. So have the theory developed, have it mapped out, have it, whether it's the, if you're doing propositional theory, the logic for the prop and the argument for the proposition, if it's narrative, what the process looks like, and then insert the examples as opposed to trying to use the examples to theorize. So I think that's interesting in terms of the ordering effect of inserting your examples into the paper.
And I think that is an important thing. You know, from the beginning, everything that we were looking at, which was both the strength and the challenge of the paper, right? Everything that we were looking at was theory. You know, it was stakeholder theory, it was entrepreneurship theory, it was common ground theory. You know, everything was theory and we were trying to bring it together. That's the strength of the paper. The weakness is that's incredibly difficult to do, right? And we would have continued to confuse everybody, I think, had we not been able to go back and put the examples in. That's what helped us clarify the theory. But you're right, that's the strength, is when you are clear on your theory. At least Sybil and I were clear. Nobody else seemed to be clear. And
I want to ask about one additional thing, just in terms of taking common ground theory, which comes from linguistics, bringing it into the strategy entrepreneurship domain, but being able to do more than just apply an existing theory to a new domain, because that doesn't provide the contribution that we're looking for in an AMR paper. And the mistake that I sometimes see authors make is they find something in, I don't know, history or politics or elsewhere, and they just apply it to a management concept and think they've got an AMR paper. What are some of the things you did to move beyond just application of common ground to the initiation of entrepreneurial endeavors?
So, and I'm going to turn this over to Sybil in a second, but But, you know, again, we had a stakeholder theory, we had entrepreneurship theory, you know, that we were both operating from. And we still felt like we had a gap, a theoretical gap, if you will. And we couldn't bridge it with these two theories without bringing something else in. And so what the theory of common ground helped us was it's the glue, if you will, that held all of our theories together. So it wasn't just the application of common ground, right? So if I had like a little pyramid or a little triangle, right, you'd have stakeholder, entrepreneurship, common ground. Like the three theories are informing, because let me tell you, the common ground theory, I think, has benefited from our paper as well. I don't know if the linguistics people would agree with that, but we've made it accessible in ways that I'm not sure it was accessible before this paper. I'm going to turn it over to Sybil for her comments. Mm-hmm.
I think that's absolutely the case. And we didn't borrow common ground theory to make an application to stakeholder and entrepreneurship theory. We really have this blend. It's a blending, right? And I think that makes the difference, because as Sharon said, at the end of the day, we could also make some contribution to the linguistic theory, but we said this is not our original field, so we don't do it and we stay with the fields we are in. However, each of these theory benefits from each other, and I think that makes really the difference.
Well, what you said is so important, that you're not just applying a theory to a new setting, you're integrating alternative or different theoretical perspectives and utilizing their interactions and the elements of each to create something that's new and that's different and that's novel. So we're coming towards the end now, but I want to ask a question of each of you, and it's going to be slightly different for each of you. So Sybil, you got to work with Sharon. Sharon's published a number of AMR articles. She's been an associate editor at AMR. I'd love to know from you, what did you learn through the process of working with her that's valuable for others who might be trying to embark on the process of writing an AMR paper? So I'd love for you to just think about that. And then Sharon, from your perspective, having sat in the editor's seat for three and however many years that it drags on and so on, and reflecting that back on sitting in the author's seat and as you interact both, what would be your advice, perspective, insights that you might provide to someone trying to write an AMR paper? So those are the two questions I want to sort of end with. So Sybil, if we can get your take on any lessons learned, insights gained, perspectives generated as a result of having gone through this process.
Actually, I learned enormously from Sharon, because Sharon was so knowledgeable how to develop a conceptual paper. This was amazing to me, and it gives me a lot of certainty in this uncertainty, because I was always thinking, okay, if Sharon thinks that's now the way how we can do it, it's good. I have to trust. And so for me, this guidance was enormously. And on the other hand, I think I was challenging, because I was posing questions which she normally was not used to get. So we had this enormous learning that was amazing. And I'm really very thankful to Sharon, who have this endeavor. And for the most, I'm very, very thankful for our friendship that developed, because in this conversational experiment, we could develop a bond and turned out to be a friendship. That's lovely. Thank you.
That's awesome. And that also makes the process.
And children and health problems. And I mean, all the things. I mean, we're like besties at this point, right? Because we've just gone through life together.
Yeah. And forming that kind of connection, Sybil and I were talking about earlier too, that you actually like your co-authors and you enjoy working with each other makes the process that much better, because if all you're going to do, again, is rely on the outcome for any form of gratification or satisfaction, you're probably going to be disappointed. So it's good to hear that that friendship emerged. Sharon, what about yourself from the perspective of sort of offering any kind of perspective, advice, useful insights to people who want to try and develop new theory, write conceptual papers? Those are the people who listen to this podcast. So what might you offer?
So, you know, it's interesting being an author as opposed to an editor or a reviewer, right? Like we would get some of the reviews back and I'd read them and I'd be like, oh, you know, and the editors would say certain things and I'd be like, oh, you know, and because you're coming at it from all these years of you doing it, right? And so that is hard as an editor to step back and say, you know what? I don't have like a patent on the editorial process. I don't have a patent on what editors have to do. I don't have a patent on the review process, right? You know, I have to sit back and I have to learn from these people now. And that is incredibly hard, I think, or it was for me. I don't know if it would be hard if I did it again, but it certainly was hard at the time. But I'd be, poor Sybil, she'd have to hear me. I'd be like, I can't believe they said such a thing and blah, 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 blah. And I can't believe the editors haven't given us more direction or this or that or the other thing, right? And so that's the hard thing once you've been in that seat, to step back and say, okay, I'm not the expert on this one. Somebody else is. I'm the author on this, right? And so that is incredibly, or at least it was for me. But I think at the end of the day, the one thing I did have that I always remembered, editors and reviewers are volunteers. And they are volunteers that help us make our work, not their work, our work better, right? And this paper, you know, the process model, the examples, you know, and not the specifics, but the ideas on how to make the paper better came out of the review process. And, you know, how thankful must we be to those people who helped us get to this point? How much gratitude? I mean, they don't even have their names acknowledged, right? We acknowledge three anonymous reviewers, right? How grateful must we be to someone who, out of the kindness of their hearts, because that's what volunteering, that's what reviewing is. It's the kindness of somebody's heart has chosen to work with us to make our paper better. And so, you know, I think we discount that a lot. And that's probably what saved me from being an obnoxious editor, is I knew that everyone who was working on this was a volunteer. They were doing this out of the kindness of their hearts. They were good people. They genuinely, you know, wanted to see the paper published. And so everything that they were doing wasn't from a place of whatever. It was from a place of kindness. It was from a place of humility, really. And so that's important to remember when you're an author. And I think that ultimately saves you.
Awesome. Yeah, you need that saving at times, because it can get a little bit tenuous, or you can feel a little bit victimized or attacked. And really the recognition, especially at AMR, that there's this developmental perspective or process that even if the paper's not going to get published at AMR, the intention is to make it better and to try and adopt that perspective. It makes the whole process a little easier. Yeah. Well, thank you to the two of you. And Sharon, I just want to, you know, say thank you to you for when I stepped into my role as an associate editor, you were very gracious in helping me and providing time to talk me through what it's going to take, and certainly set me up to start from a position of strength. So thank you for mentoring me in that way. And thank you to both of you for now at this stage, giving up your time to share your perspectives and insights with others who want to write AMR papers. This process is intended to be a teaching process, a mentorship process, a sort of from a distance helping others process. And we hope that it turns out to be that way. So thanks for your time, effort, and energy, Sybil and Sharon, in providing your perspectives on the background to this paper.
And thank you. Thank you for all your service. Thank you for being that kind, giving service person, because that's what you've been. So thank you.
Yes, awesome. And thank you that you give young people and other authors the opportunity to learn from people who had the opportunity to publish something. I think that's wonderful.
Thanks.